Good morning. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. News time is 8:19. I have Chris Robinson on the line from the Summit County Council to give us an update on yesterday's meeting. Welcome, Chris. Thanks.
Thank you, Leslie.
This is Carolyn.
Oh, Carolyn. Excuse me.
No worries.
So, I should know better.
No, well, yes, you should perhaps. But anyway, yesterday, the council made two appointments to the East County Planning Commission, Clint Benson from Hennifer, and then Rich Sontag from Promontory was reappointed. Does this meet the goal of having a planning commission that reflects all areas of the East Side?
I think so. We now have three commissioners from the North Summit area and three from the South, and then Rich, being a Promontory resident, is sort of in between. And so we think we've represented both ends of the eastern part of the county well. A lot of the proposals we've been getting lately are in North Summit, and so we thought it important that we have at least three members up there.
Okay, and do you anticipate any conflicts of interest with Rich being assigned again to the commission?
You know, we've made it pretty clear that on any matter that relates to Promontory or the, its sister company, Southridge, that he should have no involvement, not participate in any way whatsoever. He's not working for Promontory, but he may have a residual interest in the event that the project is sold, may get some sort of a payout, he indicated. But he's working for the new owners at Daybreak and doing consulting on other projects unrelated to Promontory. On balance, we feel that he brings a lot to the table, and that having him recuse himself from participating in Promontory is a small price to pay for his expertise. In other words, ideally, we'd have a commissioner that could hear all matters, but to have him step aside for just Promontory, it's still worth having him on the other matters.
Okay. So the Central Wasatch Commission was also a topic yesterday, and Chris, you represent the county on that commission. During the council comment, you noted that they're asking members, again, if they want to put in $50,000 to the Central Wasatch Commission for their next fiscal year. You asked for input. Roger Armstrong said he doesn't know if he can tell the East Side what they get from being on the Central Wasatch Commission. And what are your thoughts on that? How do you respond?
Well, I accomplished what I set out to do, which was to broach the subject with our council, just as my other council, in preparation for a meeting this Monday. And as far as what we get out of the Central Wasatch Commission, one of the things that has been of most interest to me and to our residents is the federal designation that would basically put additional protections on the public lands in the Central Wasatch, of which there's almost 1,000 acres in Summit County that drop over into the monitors above the Park City Mountain and Canyons Village. And these are lands that are coveted for backcountry skiing and dispersed recreation. And I'm eager to participate in making sure that that protection is in place. I think that there are watershed values to Park City and the Snyderville Basin from the Central Wasatch, and as much as a lot of Park City's water comes from leases of water rights owned by Salt Lake City Corporation, come from the Central Wasatch. And then as we move forward into potential Olympic bid, there'll be a lot of attention brought on the area, on the whole project area for the Central Wasatch, which includes the Snyderville Basin. And so then a fourth thing, I think it's more intangible, but it's the Central Wasatch has been a forum for the leaders, the local government leaders and the head of UDOT on the Wasatch front and back to get together on a regular basis. Mayor of Salt Lake City, Mayor of Salt Lake County, the mayors of Cottonwood Heights and Mill Creek, and Representative Sandy, and the head of UDOT, to have a forum to discuss issues and things. And I think that those relationships are valuable. So, you know, what it's worth to the county, I can't put a dollar figure on it, but I think it's good to have a seat at the table, and I think that we should, you know, pay our fair share, whatever that is, and we'll determine that as we left it. We'll have a work session on it. The Central Wasatch Commission is working on seeking long-term funding sources that don't require its members to contribute in this same fashion, but that's going to take some time.
Is the seat at the table, is that the price tag, $50,000 at this
point?
No,
that was just the number that's what we paid over the last 3 years, each of the last 3 years. And so the simple request was, well, let's continue that for another year. You know, in Park City's case, it's $100,000. In Salt Lake City's case, it's $200,000. So it's, each of those governing boards determine
was there a
what
vote
they want to do.
Was there a vote taken on that among the council members, or?
Could you ask that again? Was there a vote taken?
Yeah, was there a vote taken on the $50,000 payment?
No, it wasn't. We'd want to serve that up on an agenda. And you know, we've already set our 2019 budget, and so it would have to come from a contingency or some other, you know, shifting of funds within the budget.
Okay.
And so we're going to have another meeting on it, but we'll talk more.
Let's talk a little bit about the Kilby Road redesign project. There's been a lot of angst about it over the last year. There was a peer review study done by RB&G Engineering. What kind of complaints, concerns have you heard from the citizens about the project and the way it's all shaped out?
Well, we've had one prominent critic who wasn't able to attend last night, but who wrote us a letter. And his basic contention is that the bike lanes are improperly designed and dangerous. And there have been other, sporadic criticism about that it will be difficult to plow snow on it because of the islands and things like that. This latter issue hasn't proven a problem, and I jested that you just haven't had a winter to test it, but I think this winter was a satisfactory test. The study revealed that we should have designed some of the horizontal curves foot radius versus 150-foot radius. The larger the radius, the more gentle the turn. And that can be remedied by merely restriping the road where we put the painted lines, and we need to restripe it anyway this spring. And so that's not a big deal. It also revealed that we need to put in two additional handicapped crosswalks that were in the plans, but we've somehow slipped between the cracks. But the study said it was an unusual design, but the bike lanes for this type needed to be at least 4 feet in width. If there were a hard surface like a wall or retaining wall or something adjacent, then it needed to be a minimum of 5 feet, but that's not our case here. And I don't know if we would have done anything in hindsight differently, but the road is accomplishing what we wanted it to do, which was to increase capacity by having pullouts for the, you know, for the left-hand turning movements and slowing traffic down, because you have to pay attention. It's not just a straight shot. It has these curves and things in it as you meander around islands and turnouts.
Okay, and then you mentioned there were a couple of crosswalks that need to be put in?
Yes.
Okay, and what's the plan for that work? Is it something we'll be doing this spring, or?
Yeah, I can't say exactly. I suspect that it's more spring work. We're certainly not going to re-stripe it this time of year. You need warm temperatures on the asphalt and needs to be a clean surface, and that's hard to do when you've got a lot of moisture and salt and whatnot.
Okay. Anything else that you want to cover, Chris?
No, Carolyn, I think that's good.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. News time is 8:31. My next guest is Lauren Simpson with the Alliance for a Better Utah. We have her calling in this morning. She has been following the Utah legislative session. It's coming to an end. The director, Lauren Simpson, she will be talking with us about the will of the people. Good morning, Lauren.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks for joining us. So the Alliance for Better Utah is extra busy during this 45 days of the general session. Explain what the role of your organization is during the legislative session and what it does during the rest of the year.
Sure, so we're a progressive good government group. So we're a watchdog holding elected officials accountable and advocating for progressive policies in Utah. So during the legislative session, that means that I'm the policy director, so I'm up on Capitol Hill every day, and we track all the bills that the legislature introduces and support the good ones and oppose the bad ones.
Okay, and something that your organization has recently been focused on, especially during this session, are the bills that impact the will of the people. What does that look like to you? What does that mean to the ABU? And I guess also I'd throw in there that legislators have stated that and would argue that they were elected to execute the will of the people.
Absolutely. And where we've seen the will of the people in most conflict with elected officials this year is the ballot initiative. All the changes that have been made to individual ballot initiatives, like in a special session, the legislature overwrote Proposition 2, and then at the beginning of the session, they quickly moved to overwrite Proposition 3. And then we're also looking at changes to the ballot initiative process. Legislators are now starting to look at things that would make it more difficult for initiatives to either make it on the ballot or to be implemented in a timely manner if they're passed by the voters.
So will you remind our listeners what Proposition 2 and Proposition 3 are?
Yeah, absolutely. So in November 2018, Utah voters passed 3 ballot initiatives. And that's really rare for the state because in Utah, it's already very difficult for a ballot initiative to even get on the ballot. So Proposition 2 was medical marijuana. That one passed. Proposition 3 was full Medicaid expansion, which passed. And then Proposition 4, which also passed, was set up an independent redistricting commission, so an anti-gerrymandering measure.
And we haven't heard much about adjustments or changes that the legislature's making to Prop 4. What's happening with that? Are there bills that are trying to undermine or rewrite that proposition?
Not right now, not any that we've seen, although we are expecting some changes to come in the future. Because, you know, the census won't happen until 2020, that means the redistricting process in Utah won't happen until 2021. So if the legislature wants to alter Prop 4 in any way, it has some time to do that. There's an article out this morning that the campaign behind Prop 4 has been in communication with lawmakers It sounds like those, negotiations, those conversations have stalled for right now. So right now we're still just kind of waiting to see what will happen with Prop 4 in the future.
And that would be those kinds of redistricting laws would be put in place after the census in 2020.
Yeah, so Prop 4 would require the legislature to follow certain guidelines when creating new district maps. And those are things like kind of general good government anti-gerrymandering measures, like keeping communities together, not protecting incumbents, not using any political data to draw those lines. So just kind of put some checks in it. And those maps would be a recommendation from an independent committee, which then the legislature would either adopt or it could reject, but it would just have to explain why it was rejecting those things.
Okay. There are a handful of bills that do deal with this initiative process. Can you talk a little bit about the details of what you're watching specifically? And I'm thinking about Brad Dawes, HB 133, which has passed out of committee as of yesterday.
Yeah, so in our opinion, that's definitely the worst ballot initiative process bill we're seeing. And what that bill does is it says, creates an unlevel playing field for ballot initiatives in advance based on what's in those ballot initiatives. So it says, if a ballot initiative will involve some sort of tax increase, it will be delayed. The implementation of that initiative will be delayed over a year until after the following legislative session. But if a ballot initiative contains a tax decrease, then it can go into effect, you know, right away after 60 days like we would normally expect. So we're really concerned about, you know, that the legislature is trying to pick and choose in advance what sort of ballot initiatives it supports and what initiatives it's concerned about.
What would be the argument for delaying a bill for a year?
I mean, in committee, the sponsor, Representative Doss, said that it's an ideological thing because they support bills that reduce taxes. So in advance, they're kind of rigging the system in favor, as far as implementation goes, of ballot initiatives that support policies that they personally believe in.
Okay. So both Summit and Wasatch counties voted to approve Propositions 2 and 3. And the legislature has, as you mentioned, already passed laws to override both of those. So let's funnel down a little bit deeper into Park City and Summit County, which are both fighting HB 320, which would overturn Park City's ban on plastic bags. Can you talk a little bit about where Alliance stands on that?
Yeah, that's a bill that we're concerned about as well. And there's kind of the environmental impact of this bill. You know, it's protecting plastic and plastic manufacturers over the wishes of a particular community like Park City. So you have like the environmental angle, and then you also have the good government angle because the legislature is saying, you know what, actually we don't trust local communities to make the decision for what's best for them. And it's especially problematic here because we know that local communities are the ones who deal with waste removal. They're the ones who handle trash, who handle recycling. And so as far as plastic, you know, single-use plastic goes, local communities have the responsibility, and there's the people who are best suited to make those decisions for what will make their community the strongest and the healthiest.
Yeah, and there's also HB 288, which would put some limitations on local municipalities' land use authority, specifically around gravel pits, arguments for local control. You know, what cases can or should the legislature surpass local control and regulate at a state level? Are there any areas in your group's, you know, policy that believes that?
I mean, I don't know if I could say off the top of my head when the state should interfere and when it shouldn't interfere, because obviously there's some things that should be done on a state level. Like, we have a state board of education because public education is, you know, it's more effective, and it's good to have like one body overseeing the entire public education system. But it's concerning in instances like you mentioned, like with the plastic bags, with the bill prohibiting bans on plastic bags, and a bill offering protection to gravel pits over the concerns of residents. Those are really local issues, and so it's concerning to see a state strip power away from local entities because it doesn't like what those local entities might do.
Yeah, the legislature sort of takes this position that it's a small majority of people who possibly should not get to decide on laws for a whole state. And kind of going back to the propositions that we talked about, you know, their argument is that people didn't understand what the propositions meant. They didn't really understand the repercussions. So they have to make those decisions. They have to make the bigger decisions for the state as a whole. And I guess it would apply also to the, you know, ban on the ban of plastic bags, that this is causing hardship for the communities, the businesses in those communities. So we have to make that decision. How do you combat that? What do you have to say in regard to that? Is there any legitimacy behind it?
I mean, I definitely think there's some legitimacy. I don't believe that voters are uninformed and don't know what they want, and they need, you know, the big, strong legislature to hold their hand and tell them what they want. But, I mean, we elect our representatives for a reason, and that's because voters don't have the time of day to, you know, dive into the wonky technical details of each policy. That's a burden that we expect our legislators to lift. But there's a big difference between making small fixes to ease the implementation of what voters wanted and completely rewriting a bill in the image of what lawmakers might want it to look like, what they would personally prefer. Because we do expect, you know, and I will say, especially with ballot initiatives, it's kind of a clumsy way to pass legislation. And so we always expect there to be little fixes. You know, there are always little ways to improve a bill, but there's a very big difference between making those little fixes to help better implement what voters want versus, you know, passing big changes to a bill that undermine what voters voted for. Because voters might not be able to explain, you know, or they might not know all the little details of a bill, but they know the gist of it and they know what it does.
Okay. What else? Are there other bills and issues that you're following closely?
I mean, as far as Will of the People goes, that they're only about a couple more weeks in the legislative session, so we'll just be waiting to see what pops up. We'll be definitely keeping our eye on tax reform and making sure that we want that, you know, if we're going to be expanding the sales tax, we want to make sure that it's done in a fair way. It's applying to, you know, services with big lobbies and not unfairly putting an unfair burden on low-income people who might not be able to afford to pay that.
Okay. We're almost at the end of the general session. How would you characterize the theme of this session, 2019 session?
Yeah. We just have two more weeks. So it's gonna fly by.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining us this morning. Appreciate that input.
Thank you so much.
Bye now. That's Lauren Simpson with the Alliance for a Better Utah. Good morning. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. My final guests this morning are two paramedics with the Park City Fire District, Dirk Groh and Logan Rodriguez. They've both been recognized at a recent event at the University of Utah Clinical Neurosciences Center. I think it was called the EMS Night Out. And it has to do with some of the work that you gentlemen had done on a victim, a stroke victim, who was dining here in Park City back last fall, I presume. And just some of the early intervention that occurred as far as the way you handled the emergency. Thank you for joining us. And Dirk, why don't you start off? Tell us a little bit about the event that you attended just a couple weeks ago at the university.
Yeah, we attended the EMS Night Out, and they were recognizing the stroke patient that we went on. They gave us both an award for it, for our recognition in stroke. They had a doctor speaking and talking about the procedure that he did for the patient, which was initially they gave him TPA,
mm-hmm.
and that wasn't helping. So they were able to go through his femoral artery and go up and find the clot and extract it at that point while the patient was talking to him.
What's TPA?
It's a form of clot buster. So if somebody's having a stroke, then it can go in and break that up for them.
And is it an intravenous type of treatment?
Yep.
That a paramedic would typically, it would be protocol that you would give that if you suspected a stroke?
We don't give that in the field. They give that at the hospital.
Okay.
So we were able to get him down there in about 42 minutes from the call, and we got him down to the U, and they were able to get that on give it to him within an hour.
Okay. So, Logan, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do when you arrive at a scene where you do suspect that it's a stroke?
Yeah, so we have ways to tell pretty quickly whether a patient's having a stroke and what kind of stroke. Patients will present in a certain way, and it's our job to find that out really quickly because time is life for these patients. The quicker that we can get them to a facility that can treat them, and that's really important too, is getting them to the right facility. So, you know, living up here in Park City, we have a rural hospital. They might not have all the resources or there that day that might be able to treat the stroke patient. So we, like Dirk was saying, is that we recognized it really quick as we got onto scene, and we made the decision not to mess around on scene. Get them down to U of U as quickly as possible. And that was kind of the most significant part about this call was the time frame. So from the time that we got the call sitting at the station, by the time the patient was in the CAT scan at the U of U was 42 minutes. And that's pretty impressive. And a lot of things have to go right in order for that to happen.
And there was a bit of a ceremony because the patient was able to attend this event.
Which was really cool for us because we don't really get to see the patients after we drop them off in the hospital. Some of the bigger calls we'll get some follow-up on and hear what kind of the prognosis was, how they did, their outcome, but we don't ever run into them again. So it was cool to see him and normal and to see what he was saying about the call, what he remembered. So it was special for us to be able to talk to the patient.
Yeah, I bet it is. So time is a huge issue. You said 42 minutes. Did that involve calling for a medical helicopter?
It didn't. And that's all on our judgment, whether that's going to be faster or not. And in this case, it wasn't. By the time we call a helicopter, by the time they land, load the patient, we could already be in the canyon headed down to the U and just a couple minutes away. So it just depends on the call, whether we call a helicopter or not. Sometimes it's faster and sometimes it's not.
Yeah. So Dirk, what is the most stressful kind of call that you take?
I would think trauma for me is the most stressful just because there's so much going on in that. And it could go two different ways. It could cause from medical or traumatic event, so trauma for sure.
Yeah,
most.
So when you have in place certain protocols for dealing with certain kinds of diagnoses, is this something that you all train on? Do you have updates? Do you have continuing education on it? That type of thing. Because, like dealing with a stroke victim would that kind of treatment would be evolving constantly.
Yeah.
And the awareness and how to keep up with it. How does that work with the fire district?
Yeah, with the fire district, we have a training division. We have two people in charge of it, and then we do continuing training every shift, whether it's medical or fire. So we continue that every shift. And then we just update new protocols or new equipment coming out or new studies. And then we go from there and work them into our own protocols.
Okay. And we have Chief Paul Hewitt here with the Park City Fire District.
Hi,
there. Wait, is there anything else you'd like to say about this event? Because they're going to be very reserved, I'm guessing.
Yeah, they are. They're very modest here. I'm very proud of our membership. I'm proud of our training division and proud of all the hospitals we work with. The U of U, Dr. Grandi did an excellent job telling us what he did. And it's remarkable, the technologies that are out there. He went through a groin artery while the patient was conscious, and the thrombolytics, or the clot busters, had busted up the biggest of the clots, but there was still a medium-sized clot that Dr. Grandi had to go up and get. And he went through a groin artery all the way into the brain while the patient was conscious and talking to him. And the patient told Dr. Grandi, "Man, that hurts." And Grandi said, was very apologetic and said, "I'm getting there as quick as I can." And the patient felt this clot being removed from his brain and then began to speak much more normally. And Dr. Grandi went out into the waiting room where Mr. Hampton's wife was waiting. Mr. Hampton, by the way, has been very gracious and given us permission to talk about this. Usually this would be a violation of HIPAA, but he's helped us a lot. And anyway, Dr. Grandi went out into the waiting room and said, he's normal. I mean, remarkable, and these paramedics deserve all the credit in the world, as well as all of our paramedics. We're very capable. The visitors and residents of Park City should know that we have a very, very capable EMS personnel, and they're very well trained. Chief Emery keeps them up to date on all of the latest. It's remarkable where we're going. You know, today we were playing with our phones, and back in the day when I was a paramedic, translating for people that didn't speak English was difficult. You had to ask them about their medications. Now you just ask Siri, translate where are your medications and are you allergic to medications immediately. Siri talks to the patient. We have, laryngoscopes when we intubate people. We now have cameras on those. And we in the Park City Fire District stay abreast of all of the latest technologies, and we're fortunate enough to have the resources to implement those technologies. And then the part that nobody can, no technology is going to do is the personnel. Dirk and Logan did a fantastic job for Mr. Hampton, and the outcome was very good. They made some really pertinent, quick decisions, and this call went extremely well.
Well, and it seems like being able to respond that quickly is almost an instinctive thing, not delaying and not giving it a second consideration, but really moving on it.
That's a real good point, Carolyn. Yeah, we have an EMS lab. We have an overhead camera. All of our paramedics train. They do each call until it becomes a habit and instinctual. They watch themselves perform. They're forced to watch how they performed on some of these traumas or full arrests or pediatric calls. You know, you're asking about stressful calls. Pediatric calls are very stressful. Things happen quick when children get hurt. But we try to make sure that they're very, very well prepared before they get into these stressful situations.
Yeah. How big is your team?
We have 90 full-time employees. We have 7 staffed fire stations. We staff between 2 and 3 firefighters. About 80% of what we do is medical. So we know if we can get a 2 or 3-member team to the scene very quick on a medical call, that the outcome will be positively changed.
Yeah, interesting. Well, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Anything else you'd like to say, Paul?
No, thanks to Dirk and Logan. They did a fantastic job.
Yeah, we
thanks
really
for having us.
Appreciate your work. Thank you.
Thank you.